Welcome to the Kerry Newhoff Leadership Podcast, a podcast all about leadership, change, and personal growth. The goal? To help you lead like never before in your church or in your business. And now, your host, Kerry Newhoff.
Well, hey, everybody, and welcome to the podcast. My name is Kerry Newhoff, and I hope our time together today helps you lead like never before. I am so excited that today is here. Two reasons for that. Number one, our guest. You heard him back in episode 53, and he's back with a brand new interview. I sat down with Ravi Zacharias, and we talked about the changing face of evangelism, what's wrong with preaching today, and how to make it better, and how to actually connect with the generation whose questions are changing. It's fascinating. In fact, the last 5 minutes of the interview, I have not been able to stop thinking about as a preacher since we had the conversation. So I think you're going to really, really enjoy it. I'm so grateful for Ravi. He's an exceptionally busy person. For him to free up another half hour to sit down and invest in you is incredible. Now, I'm excited about that, but here's another reason I'm super excited. I've hinted that this day is coming, and it's here. We, this week, pass 1 million downloads of this podcast. Is that not crazy? I mean, that is crazy. About 18 months ago, we started this, and it was just a hope and a dream that we would be able to have some great conversations and that they would help you lead, even lead like never before, like we talk about. And to think that this has actually now been downloaded a million times is nuts. And you know why? You know why? Because you guys have been so generous. You've been so awesome. You've told your friends about it. You've shared it with your team. You've sent encouraging emails. You have left over 350 reviews on iTunes. You've shared it on your social media, and you've told other leaders about it. And so I think we ought to celebrate. So here's how I'd like to celebrate. I'd like to give you some gifts. And how about we start with this? Gift number one, Starbucks on me. And here's how we can do that. As much as I would love to actually go to Starbucks with you, what I'll do is I will load a Starbucks gift card onto my Instagram once a day for the next 5 days. So the day of release for this podcast is Tuesday, April 12th. Also my baby sister Jen's birthday. Happy birthday, Jen. And starting today until Saturday, April the 16th, 2016, I will be uploading at random times during the day a Starbucks gift card. And what you can do is just take your phone into a Starbucks and hold that picture on Instagram up to their scanner. And as long as there's money on the card, and I'll be generous this week, you will be able to get a free Starbucks. So I hope that's going to work for you. And I hope you'll be one of the people who are first to Starbucks to get a free Starbucks. But I would love to buy that for you. So the easiest way to do that, just follow me on Instagram. And I'm not really into the whole turn on notifications thing if you've been following that on Instagram. But one way to make sure that you hear about it as soon as it happens is to turn on notifications on Instagram. And then if you happen to be in line at Starbucks, boom, you got a free coffee. So I would love to do that. So that's once a day. I'm going to be doing that, giving away some Starbucks for you. And you can find that on Instagram. But here's the second way we're going to do it. Last fall, I released a book called Lasting Impact, 7 Powerful Conversations That Can Help Your Church Grow. You guys have been so encouraging about that book. Now, I want to give you another gift. As you may have heard me hint, there is a brand new resource being released at the end of the month. It's the Lasting Impact Team Edition. I've recorded 8 videos that accompany the book. And so it's going to be available for broad release in a few weeks. But what I'd like to do to celebrate 1 million downloads on the podcast is, again, every day until Saturday, give away a free team edition, the video companion to the book. So this is a significant value. I would love to get it into your hands for free. And as soon as that is released, get it into your hands. So what you can do for this actually is, and this is only for people who have read the book. Now you can buy the book today and you can, you know, read it and that sort of thing, but I don't want any fake reviews. We want you to leave a review on Amazon. So if you've read the book and you've appreciated it, just go and leave a review on Amazon. And every day, today, Tuesday, right through until Saturday, me and my team are going to go on Amazon. We're going to read the reviews. Now, here's what happens when you leave a review on Amazon. They send you a confirmation email. And what I want you to do to qualify your ballot is to forward that confirmation email to this email address. Send it to leadership@carrienewhoff.com. That's leadership@carrienewhoff.com. That's your ballot. We're going to sort through those emails and the reviews. We're going to pick one, and one of you every day is going to win the team edition, the video companion to Lasting Impact, 7 powerful conversations that will help your church grow. I've shot a 20 to 25 minute video for every single chapter. And I've shot a bonus video on how to have a conversation, difficult conversation, without blowing your team apart. And what you can do if you're studying the book with your executive team, your staff, your leadership team, you just play the videos before the conversation, and hopefully that sets you up for a great conversation. So again, 2 ways to win. Number one, just follow me on Instagram. And if you're near a Starbucks, I'll buy you coffee. That's every day until Saturday. And then number two, if you've read Lasting Impact, please leave a review on Amazon. Forward the confirmation of that review that you'll get from Amazon to leadership@carrienewhoff.com. So I would love for you to be able to do that. And that's a way of getting some free stuff into your hands and to say thank you for being such an awesome, awesome, awesome group of people. You guys make this so motivating. So there's a lot ahead. In fact, we're just getting started on this podcast, and it's going to be a lot of fun. And in the meantime, what I'd love you to do, if you're sipping Starbucks or reading Lasting Impact, is sit back and listen to my conversation with the one and only Ravi Zacharias. It's a thrill to have Ravi Zacharias back on the podcast today. Thank you so, so much for making some time to engage with me and lots of leaders who are listening. Thank you.
My honor.
So, Ravi, you've had now several decades of public ministry, and I want to talk to you just about how evangelism and apologetics has changed, because a lot of our listeners, well, most of them are church leaders, or they serve in the local church, maybe they work in the marketplace, but there's a number of us who are preachers, and I think all of us are trying to share our faith, and we know intuitively that the game has changed. We know that we're more post-Christian, more post-modern. So I want to focus in particular on the West, even though you speak all over the world. And has Western culture, in your view, become truly postmodern and post-Christian? And if so, what does that mean to you?
It's changed dramatically, Kerry. I, as you say, have been around this a few times now. I started in Toronto in 1972, just after graduating from what is now Tyndale. And so that's, I'm into my 44th year. And I was licensed by the Christian and Missionary Alliance, and our headquarters at that time was in Burlington, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I had dinner in Burlington last night.
Okay, I was there, and many of my colleagues have either passed away or moved on. The entire framework of church evangelism used to be a big thing then, you know, once or twice a year a church would hold a week of evangelistic meetings, or Sunday evening was considered, quote, an evangelistic service over against the morning, which was worship. Today, it is not just, I think, the culture that has changed in terms of its thinking, being postmodern, but the busyness of life that is available right in your own home with a big screen and all the programs and all the sporting events, all that you can do at home. Coming out to church has been not become a priority anymore to a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. No, you're right. Everything's changed. 44 years, that is a long and vibrant ministry. So in terms of how people think, like when you think about how people engage the faith, how have you had to change, not your message, that's what I'm talking about, the gospel is eternal, it never changes, but your approach? Like, does logic work the same way it used to? How have the questions that unchurched people are asking shifted over your 4 decades of ministry?
You know, here in the United States last week, one of the Supreme Court justices, Antonin Scalia, very suddenly passed away. And so one of the networks was playing some of his speeches, and it was interesting. In one of his talks, when he said this, he put 3 lines together. He said, you know, sophisticated people can believe in God. Sophisticated people can believe in a personal God. Sophisticated people can believe in the person of Jesus Christ. And the fact that he even had to say that was reflective of the fact that culture basically sees belief in a personal God and the message of Jesus Christ as sort of antiquated or certainly not intellectually tenable. That's the way it is now seen. Atheism or naturalism is given a stridency and a platform, and sort of they are the graduate level thinkers, backwards type thing. If you really want to go back to kindergarten thinking, you're welcome to it, but it does not meet the intellectual test in the arena. At least that's the way a lot of people make assumptions. Well, one of the clues of this is when I finish talking, sometimes get off the platform, as I was yesterday speaking here in another city. I don't know how many people came and said to me, you know, it's nice to hear somebody who sounds intelligent. Now, they really are thinking they're paying you a compliment, and it is intended to do that, but it tells you what lies beneath the surface, that they don't really think there is intelligence in the message, and it catches them off guard. So we have to cross those hurdles.
That's really interesting to me, because I agree. There's an anti-intellectual assumption about Christianity that if you really think about it, Christianity will fail. Why has that cultural underpinning shifted so rapidly? Like, why do you think? Was it that we did a very poor job of defending our faith in previous decades? Is it that just pluralism has taken root? What is it in your mind? If we can get to the root, we can figure out how to address it.
You know, I arrived in Canada in 1966, May of 66, mm-hmm. and I was working right downtown at College and Young. And I remember it was right around the time of the, quote, so-called hippie movement. And you would go to Yorkville and you'd see a lot of that new culture coming into place, both in not just hairstyles, but in attitudes. And the attitude is what has lingered. It was an anti-establishment state of mind. The Vietnam War lent itself to it. Distrust in political leadership. There was an upheaval going on. It was an overthrow of the absolute in every direction, be it political, be it spiritual, be it moral, be it cultural. It was this, I am the captain of my soul. Tell me how I should think. That movement that began, I think, in a robust fashion in the 60s, they then became the academics of the 80s, produced mm-hmm. a generation that with which we are now living, and the snowball effect took place. The academic world is the biggest rebel against any thinking of the absolute. And so if the absolutes are jettisoned and relativism holds sway, and I'm the master of my own soul, then an over and above message is not going to be very welcome. I think that's where it goes back. I remember in the 80s listening to Everett Koop and Francis Schaeffer in Toronto. I think they had come.
Oh, yeah.
Certainly Schaeffer had come to the Ryerson Auditorium there and listening to him. And he was predicting that the day would come in the West where if you said the name of Jesus Christ, you'd have to qualify and explain what you mean, because a lot of that generation wouldn't be able to make one accurate statement about him that would be historically true. So this, I think, is the outcome of about 50 years now of rebelling against the absolute.
Yeah, I think that's very true. And that's what we find, I know, where I serve north of Toronto, is we have to explain who Jesus is. Like, people do not know. If you're truly unchurched, you really have no idea who Jesus is, any more than the average Christian might be able to say more than a sentence or two about Buddha. You know, we just don't know.
And then the influx into a pluralistic culture. When I moved to Canada, there were 500 Indians in Toronto. Today in Toronto alone, there are 500,000 Indians. So as this mix of culture has taken place, it has been in vogue to sort of say, well, no one worldview has all the answers. It sounds very good. The Christians are the only ones who claim to have exclusive truth. Nothing could be farther from the truth. But this mix, along with the predisposition of a rebellion against the absolute, I think has made for quite a volatile blend in what we are now living with. It's had huge ramifications for the redefinition of everything in life.
It has. So help me out. I'm somebody who preaches most Sundays in a local church, and there's a lot of leaders listening all over the U.S., Canada, Western Europe, Australia, New Zealand, kind of the Western world as we know it, who are resonating with what you're saying. And we're like, we have to wade into that week after week after week. If you're in the Bible Belt, you tend not to see that level of thinking in the older generation. But when you're dealing with millennials, you run into it. If you're in a postmodern culture like Canada, you run into it in every generation, as you've indicated, because those hippies are now in their 60s and 70s, right?
Exactly.
And so you see that everywhere. So if you're advising people who preach in North America or a Western context, what would you tell us? Like, okay, this is how you should engage that culture. Is it an intellectual argument? Is it an emotional argument? Is it all of the above? None of the above? How do we begin to step into that? Because clearly we've got room to grow. We haven't exactly turned the tide.
You know, it's very interesting and it's a tough question. I'll tell you why. I was speaking at a global discipleship conference in Manila about 3 weeks ago. And I was sitting around with a couple of the leaders there, Peter Tan Chi from Manila and Edmund Chan from Singapore. And we were talking about why is preaching, good preaching, so hard to find? I don't know how the conversation went in that direction. And the thought came to my mind, you know, if you take your car to a mechanic, you expect them to have good mechanics who understand the car. You go to a medical facility, you want to meet with good doctors who understand how to diagnose and so on. Somehow in the preaching ministry, we have minimized the gift and the sharpening of that gift. Because the message is true, we assume it will carry its own weight. But you have to have good communicators of that. So if I look at just three requirements, Carrie, this way I
see
the message has to be interestingly presented. If it is not interesting to the person listening, we are competing against a world that has sort of got a scorching paganism out there. You can't set a tepid Christianity beside it. Has to be interesting. Then it has to be intellectually rigorous. The person needs to respect the coherence with which you're presenting the argument. But the goal ultimately has to be inspirational. If you can inspire your audience, they will come back because they will park in their minds the memory of, boy, I really wanted to make a difference when I walked out of here. So from an interesting communication pattern to being intellectually rigorous and to be inspiring, those are the components that have to be there. Yes, the word of God is true. The scriptures cannot be broken, and it abides forever. If we have that treasure, let us be able to communicate it with the full force of a gifting and a calling and a strengthening of that gift. That has to be done from the pulpit. We sort of substituted that by programming.
I think it was
John Stott who said to me once, and I think he also mentioned in one of his books or articles, he said, the day the pastor's study door sign was replaced by the pastor's office, he said something changed.
Ooh.
Big, very, very definitive difference. Meaning my primary responsibility as a pastor is to be able to effectively communicate. But it became an office and administrative roles became vast in the bigger churches and managing a staff. So it's had its hazards. And with the change of culture and the change of success stories, the church has been seriously affected.
Of the three, inspirational, intellectually vigorous, and then
interesting.
Interesting. Yeah, I got that wrong. Which do you think has suffered the most of those three in the North American or Western pulpit?
The intellectual rigor has suffered. Yeah. It really has. You know, recently I was speaking to a group of journalists when you were there in Washington, D.C. I was
doing
the night before the prayer breakfast, I was speaking to the media, invited by Cal Thomas, and I positioned two statements with which I began. Malcolm Muggeridge, who was pessimistic and thought violence and nuclear destruction would be in the future of mankind. As he said, a weary, battered old brontosaurus will become extinct. And then I positioned it with Martin Luther King's statement that I believe unarmed truth and unconditional love will have the final word in reality. I said, now, ladies and gentlemen, which of these two destinations do you think we are going to get to? And if we want to side with Dr. King's statement, unarmed truth and unconditional love, I said, then I have a question for you. The reigning worldview is naturalistic. The reigning worldview is scientific single vision. Where in naturalism or with the scientific single vision can you find unarmed truth and unconditional love? Those are metaphysical, philosophical ideas. They're not scientific ideas. You don't extend engineering into unarmed truth and unconditional love. Those are ideas that are moving us spiritually and philosophically. So if we think that those two components are important, then naturalism is not going to have the answers. And yet that is the reigning worldview in the academy today. And it is fascinating to see the response. In fact, one person in the audience, she said she'd been in the State Department for 30 years. She said the mood right now on Capitol Hill, she said, is toxic. She said, is there any way to bring this kind of a talk to all of our political leadership and let them understand that the engine that we are building is not going to take us to the destination which we are hoping for.
Hmm. And in many ways, before, it was King's view which was winning the day, not the naturalism that you talk about.
That is right. Hmm. And actually, the finest institutions were inspired by spiritual depth. Certainly in the United States, when you think of Yale and Harvard, and Princeton, the divines, those who are involved in that, were Dartmouth as well, were quote reverends. They were doctors of divinity. They believed education was important, and science was thriving in the ages of a spiritually rigorous worldview. Now, sort of, science has taken over and evicted the very progenitor of their possibilities here. So it's become there's a reason for it. An absolute makes its demand on me. And when I reject the absolute, I want to be the captain of my own soul.
That makes sense. So when you think about the intellectualism required by that, a lot of people would say old style apologetics, evidence-based apologetics, just doesn't resonate as much in a postmodern, relativistic, pluralistic world, particularly among younger adults, where they're like, you know, I just don't really think that truth is absolute, and you say Jesus, and I say all world religions are the same, which we know empirically is not true, but that's what they think, and that the evidence-based classic apologetics don't work as much. I've even had a previous podcast guest say that, you know, when a 70-year-old hands C.S. Lewis, a C.S. Lewis book to a 25-year-old, that means an awful lot to the 70-year-old, but the 25-year-old is asking different questions. Do you agree or do you disagree? How do you feel about that?
On the illustration, I only partially agree. On the argument, there's a lot of weight to it. I still see a lot of young people reading C.S. Lewis because he captured the story. I mean, the whole Narnia series on television and all. He has a lot of authority. A friend of mine and I are in correspondence now, and C.S. Lewis is front and center in that person's reading. It can be done to have an answer, but it cannot be front and center with the postmodern mindset. Let me illustrate this. Beginning of this year, I was speaking at the Passion Conference, and there were 14,000 students. I think it was about 115 different universities represented from 47 countries or something like that. Those who came for counseling during that weekend, they came for two primary issues, the number one and number two issues that they were challenged with: pornography and suicide.
Now,
I don't know if they recognize the connection between the two. Pornography is ultimately the denuding of the other person, and suicide is the denuding of your own self. You move from devaluing the other to the devaluation of your own life and your own self. So the issue of meaning, purpose, value, a significance, the challenge of sensuality over against the lack of fulfillment that it brings, ultimately, those are the real issues that the young are facing. And you talk to them on these issues, and they are listening very, very carefully. And the reason is the purveyors of this stuff are now not having to wait for the consumer to come to a shop and buy it. They are parked on the hip or the holster or in the purse of an individual. It's right within the reach of their instruments. And they are overcoming the imagination of a whole generation. And the enchantment of what sexuality was meant to be is gone. And this, I think, is a catastrophic price we have paid in our time. And the result is the shattering of the home and the intimacy in relationships. So yes, classical apologetics has its place foundationally, but it may not be the primary instrument with which you reach out. You have to have it. No problem. Those questions can still come. But in terms of the persuasive element, That's not what they're really looking for.
So help me bridge this gap, because I think you're so right. So when I look at preaching across the Western world, I see definitely this idea of, you know, some people are doing classic apologetics, they're doing evidence-based Christianity, et cetera, et cetera. And then others, I mean, the majority of growing churches are doing a pretty good job addressing pornography, addressing relationships, addressing the deeper issues of life, meaning, purpose, significance, role. I mean, I could point to a dozen series I can think of off the top of my head in growing mega churches that have addressed those issues. What seems to be missing sometimes is the marriage of the intellect and those emotional issues. Exactly what you just said. You know, I'd never, to be honest, never thought that porn and suicide were related in the sense that one devalues the other, and then the other, you know, obviously leads to devaluing the self. That's a really interesting connection. So for those of us who communicate, and those of us even who don't preach but are just in conversations, is it that we would be better off if we engage those life issues, but then had some like intellectual rigor around that? What does that look like? Like, just help us think through that. This is so fascinating.
Well, one of the reasons that the evidence-based apologetic is still valid is in the Islamic world. That's where they're attacking us. They're attacking the Christian faith. The evidence-based apologetic is very important with the Muslim. The issue of the Trinity. Issue of the death of Jesus, the whole concept of the very Son of God, the authority of the scriptures. The Muslim is very much trained, almost regimented into believing that the Christian faith doctrines. So the evidence-based apologetic works in those settings. And there's a lot from the Islamic world in the West right now. But in terms of the typical Western young man or woman who doesn't get involved in that and doesn't really care about that, for them, the application side of the message becomes very important. You see, you have an argument for the message. You have the story to illustrate the message. Then how does it apply to your life and mine? This is where I think we need to have in our theological integrity in worship. We must have theological integrity in worship. If we make worship sort of hijacked by one aspect of it, be it music, be it just proclamation, then we have not brought coherence into the mix. And ultimately, the individual is looking for coherence inside. And that's where I think worship comes into play. We must realize that this body is the temple of the living God. How do I bring that worship truth into my day-to-day living in this temporal frame of mind? I believe it's so critical that we not just take one or two links. The links have to continue, and application is that important link in a young Christian's life.
Mm-hmm. You know, that's really interesting, because the more I hear you talk, and when I hear you speak, you have a way of going from the very intellectual to the very personal and the very subjective quickly. And when I think about the broad canvas of a lot of preaching, we tend to either live in the intellectual or live in the personal. But maybe a better approach would be to fuse the two, to have intellectual elements and then some very personal and deep emotional application. That's fascinating.
I think so, because the destination is to get worshipers in spirit and in truth. The intellectual part of it is one of the stops along the way. It is the road to it, but it is not the destination point, because the danger of intellectual ideas as an emotional strength is that when emotions become emotionalism, when intellect becomes intellectualism, then you have fed one aspect of the individual and you have not brought them to the right point. The right point is the coherence of all of this. When I taught apologetics at the Alliance Theological Seminary, I also asked that the history and theology of worship be part of the apologetic curriculum. And that was my favorite course to teach, because you can get so bound in the intellectual arguments that can unfortunately yield to pride, the very heart of sin. And if argumentation is all we focus on, then we feed to the wrong element in an individual. We have to move them past it to the beauty and the surrender of the will to the person of Jesus Christ. Jesus could have done all the intellectual work that we would have wanted, and even more. But that's not where he left us. He said to the woman at the well, he said, they that worship, we must worship him, God must worship him in spirit and in truth. That was the destination point. For the Father seeketh such to worship him. If the goal is the worship of the living God, we cannot stop at either the emotional side of it or the intellectual side of it. It has to come. Liturgy plays a part here. Theology plays a part here. Lifestyle plays a part here. Family devotions play a part here. One's private reading and private devotions. These are all components that make for the person who lives his or her life out in worship.
I've found this particularly helpful, and I love the distinction between intellectualism and emotionalism, because I think you're right. They become shadows of what they could be when they're not integrated. Last question for you, because our time is almost over, and I'm so grateful for the time you made available today. But when you're on college campuses all the time, and so you're meeting the next generation day in and day out. If there's two or three questions you hear over and over again from college students, young adults, what are you hearing as the cry of the next generation?
Very interesting. Last week I was at Pepperdine University, and day after tomorrow I'll be at the University of Kentucky. We move from East Coast to West Coast, and recently some of my colleagues are in Toronto, I believe, and doing work up there. They come out. McGill did wonderful work in Quebec. What we are hearing, first of all, is a surprise element from the students who come in as skeptics, that this actually makes sense. I was at Carnegie Mellon and at University of Pittsburgh about 2 months ago, and the vice president of the Humanistic Association stood up as the last questioner. And there had been some heavy pushback on my coming there, a lot of hostile articles and all of that from the Humanist Association, atheists. And the vice president of the Humanist Association stood up and said, I want to thank you for coming here. He said, He said, I appreciate what you've said. You know, I think, Kerry, you first have to win the antagonist. In a war of ideas, the goal is not the destruction of the counterperson. The goal is to deal with the counter perspective. You cannot vanquish the quote enemy. You are to win them. And you win them in various ways. If they gain respect for you in what you are saying, you have cleared the barriers for them to listen to the heart of the message. And some of the conversions we witness are from the brightest minds or the most pragmatically driven individuals who wandered off into the terrain of a pleasure-oriented lifestyle. So you have to earn the right to be heard. And if you do that, they are willing to listen to the core of the message. We are seeing marvelous responses. Now, from the Christian viewpoint, what we hear most often is this. We hear it, I'm not exaggerating when I say thousands of times a year. Some young man or young woman will say to me, you know, I was on the verge of giving all of this up. I didn't know how to make a stand for this in the academy. I just didn't know. I'm asked to think in different categories all my student days. Said, but reading the books, or you're listening to the radio program, whatever, or they'll mention somebody who really communicated to them with intellectual rigor and the heart, and people like John Piper or Tim Keller, their names come up so often as well. It is telling me that many of our church young men and women are standing between two worlds.
Yeah.
We had bent to that borderline to bring them all the way into the worldview of the Judeo-Christian message. And when they hear it, they are thankful to you. One quick illustration, when I was going up to the green room at Pepperdine University, the man taking me up the stairs had served two tours in Iraq.
Said to me, okay, in Iraq.
Yeah, in Iraq. He said, I'd given this whole thing up. He said, all of a sudden, somebody led me to your podcast. And then I started reading and then listening. And he named a few authors too. He said, you know what? It changed my whole life completely. He said, I just want to say a big heartfelt thank you for thousands of miles away in a battle zone, listening to podcasts on the YouTube. My life was rescued. This is what we are hearing again and again and again.
That's amazing. Well, I know we are at the end of our time together. On behalf of everyone, I can't thank you enough. Thank you so much, Ravi.
Well, God bless you, Kerry. Thank you so much for having me. Wish you all the best and keep up the good work.
Thank you. You know, I've had a chance to spend a bit of time with Ravi over the last year in a couple of different settings. And every time I talk to him, I'm like, man, I can barely think fast enough to keep up with what he is saying. The guy is simply brilliant. And isn't what he had to say about preaching just so transformative for those of us who speak about, you know, needing to engage the intellect and also the emotion of people? And, you know, otherwise it becomes intellectualism or it becomes emotionalism. And that has just schooled me, challenged me as a preacher. So I hope that's been helpful for you. If you want more information, you can go to the show notes. And by the way, the contest details for this million download celebration are in the show notes. You can just go to kerrynewhoff.com/episode82. And there are details on how you can win on Instagram, so I can buy you Starbucks, and also the instructions on how you can win a copy of the Lasting Impact Team Edition as soon as it comes out. And if you don't happen to be one of the winners, just hang on, because in a couple of weeks, we're going to be releasing the Video Team Edition to Lasting Impact. And I hope that helps you, because I get asked by leaders all the time, hey, Kerry, can you come and, you know, teach this at our church? And sometimes I can, but often my schedule's just prohibitive. And if you're a smaller church, and I sure remember when I led a smaller church, you just can't afford to fly somebody in. And so this is a way of making what I hope will be very helpful teaching available at a fraction of the cost of flying me or somebody else in to work with your team. So that'll be available soon. As soon as it goes live, it'll be available at lastingimpactbook.com. And if you haven't read the book, you can get a free chapter there and all the information about my latest book, Lasting Impact. And thanks so much for all of you who are already excited about the release of the Team Edition in just a few weeks' time. So keep listening for that. And to all of you for listening, thank you. Thank you for making this so rewarding. I can't believe we're at a million, and here's to a million more, and maybe even faster than 18 months. That'll be great. So as you share this, as you leave reviews on iTunes, as you post insights to social media, you're just helping other leaders as well. And I just want to thank you so much for that. Hey, next week I'm back with Brent Ingersoll. Now imagine, for those of you trying to turn a church around, that can be difficult. Imagine doing it after a moral failure, and imagine doing it when you're like 29 years old. That is a tall challenge, and that's exactly what Brent was facing. So I would love for you to subscribe so that you don't miss next Tuesday, episode 83 of the podcast, and we'll talk to you then. I really do hope our time today has helped you lead like never before.
You've been listening to the Kerry Newhoff Leadership Podcast. Join us next time for more insights on leadership, change, and personal growth to help you lead like never before.